Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This is episode number 174, brought to you by Environments for Humans. They are promoting their CSS DevConf, which is going to be kind of an awesome one, particularly because me and Dave are going to be there, along with lots of our colleagues and awesome CSS people. The URL for that one is CSSDevConf.com. It's in Long Beach, California, on a giant boat. It's a docked boat, though, but it's the Queen Mary, and look up pictures of it. It's totally awesome. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. Also, we only have one sponsor this week, and we'll tell you more about that. Not that we plan to only have one, so I guess we'll say it's sponsored by Dave and I, but by two our beards.
Yeah. Welcome. Congratulations.
Ba-bum-bum-bum.
Shopomaniacs, you're listening to Shop Talk Show, the podcast for Beard Aficionado and BeardAficionado.com magazine. I'm Dave Rupert.
And I'm Chris Coyer, and we are, our powers combined, our Shop Talk Show. This is coming up on our 47th Rapid Fire episode. Rapid Fire, of course. We don't even need to intro it too much. No guests, no drama, just all the question on answer stuff you can handle. Last week, we had an excellent show with Mr. Andy Budd, and we talked a ton about progressive enhancement and stuff. Very fun thing to talk about on the web, and we only got to one or two questions, so that's fine. It's shop talk. We spent our time talking shop, but this is where we make up for it and try to do more questions than not questions. So let's get right into it. Mr. Daryl Hine writes in, how do you deal with minified SVGs and Git? Do you commit the minified SVGs or keep the originals around? Do you put the minified files in a different directory? Do you copy other images, PNGs, JPEGs into the same directory? I've always committed the minified versions because they're typically from Illustrator and I'm not going to edit them manually, but I found that SVGO minifies them slightly differently each time. Okay, that's weird. First of all, SVGs and Git, I guess we could start with that. SVGs and Git are fine because SVG is like a text format, so you can see diffs and stuff, although minified SVGs are, it's kind of like minified CSS, it's kind of a pain in the butt when you, like SVG does a diff line by line, but when one semicolon changes in a CSS file, the minified version just, it looks like the entire file changed because it can't, it's only one line of code, right? So it's kind of a, I'm not sure what to say about that exactly. But you need somewhere to put them, right? Like some people in the world of CSS, they have an SCSS file or whatever language you're using, and they don't check in the .css at all because they don't really consider it, like their server just does that when they deploy. It's not like an important part of the repo. It's not authored code. It's just manufactured code. It's like compiled code in a sense. I kind of like that approach because it just, keeps the Git repo a bit cleaner and stuff, especially with a deployed project. Although there's arguments back and forth, if somebody doesn't use SAS, it's sure nice to see in the repo the CSS file, especially if it's an open source project. So I guess that factors into this a bit. I don't know what to tell you. I've never seen of course you're using minified SVGs on the actual deployed project. So does it need to be, does your build process build these minified SVGs as part of deployment or not? And got any thoughts on this?
So I think the correct answer, the web standard answer, is your source control is the source of truth. Therefore, those should be source files, if I'm to say correctly. But I think in practice, what I end up doing is committing both,
Yeah, in practice, generally.
I think for me, the most common example is I use a folder of SVGs, like my UI SVGs, and then I have SVG store run through it, smash it down into one defs block, like SVG defs or whatever. and then I call it like UI SVG, and then I use SVG use to request that element.
Sure. So in that case, there's only really one minified SVG. So maybe that would be nice if it wasn't in Git, but it's kind of nice to just be there too. So anybody can pull the repo and your site kind of works and stuff. I don't think it's that big of a deal, especially because it's a text format anyway. It's like kind of fine probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's okay. But if you're doing this a lot, I mean, you probably want to add something in your compilation structure or your deploy that does all the minification for you automatically. So
the point that he makes at the end that says SVGO minifies them slightly differently each time seems a little concerning.
That's sort of weird, but
like, does it change? Is it different because you've edited it in Illustrator and saved it again and then run SVGO on it again? And then it made different choices because what was found in that file was different. It certainly shouldn't change if you just, if you ran it 10 times and it was 10 on the same exact file and the output was different 10 times. It's like, what the heck is going on there? That's not how computers work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think like SVGO will sometimes do this like change all your IDs for you thing, which is sort of weird and aggressive.
Or remove them.
So I don't like that. But I don't know. I've also heard this, like, you should optimize your SVGs, like the number of points and stuff like that. Jake Archibald's SVGOMG tool is a great way to visualize what's happening. You kind of turn switches.
Yeah, because it's not exactly lossless. It's lossy. It's just generally not that important because sometimes the decimal precision is too high on a file. Although that know that that's a bit arbitrary. Like imagine if you have a view box that's 0, 0, 100, 100, and you have 1 point of decimal precision. That's the same amount of visual precision as if the view box was 0, 0, 1, 1. You would need that. You'd need extra decimals of precision to have it look right. So it's kind of like I feel like just arbitrarily stripping precision isn't necessarily an awesome idea, or that decimal precision how much you strip away should be based on how large the view box is, because that those are so related of concepts. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's not as you found out, I believe, in the past, Dave, it's not lossless. You can like send a file through there and have it come out and be like, whoa, what happened?
Yeah. Surprise. Yeah. I'm horrible. So, yeah. And that's the thing, too. I was like, I'm just going to rip out all these numbers. And Jake's tool really helped me to see what was going on. Because, yeah, you can.
Sure.
Like,
but it's not a build step.
Yeah, it's not. I don't put it in a build step, so I like hand minify, and that's probably the stupidest way to do it. But we have some smart exports from Illustrator. Like we only do it to one decimal in Illustrator, and then we do. What else do we do? Oh, and then I'll like for critical SVGs, like big ones or whatever, I'll run it through SVGOMG, save it, and then if I want to do minification or something like that. Extreme afterwards I could, but I've also heard recently that like gzip usually gets it all done. That I'm again like black boxing gzip solving all my problems, but I've heard it does amazing things.
Yeah, gzip can't help you with the it does do amazing things to SVG. In fact, yeah, I have this in a current talk I'm doing about it, but it's, there's a lot of what gzip eats for breakfast is repetitive code, and SVG by its nature, CSS as well, is highly repetitive, mm-hmm. So it can chew that stuff up pretty good, but it doesn't help you with decimal precision very much. To Daryl's question as well, I probably would put SVGs in a different folder generally, just for your build step kind of processes. You might as well kind of have them separated. They're a different beast than pings and JPEGs and stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, they're basically Flash movies. Like SVG is a Flash competitor. So it's like you wouldn't put like JPEG, Flash movie, you guys all run the same optimization script. You want to separate those concerns.
That sounds about right. Good luck, Daryl.
All right. Pew. Next question. Oliver Morgan writes in, why are so many web apps built with Ruby on Rails? What are the benefits over a PHP framework like CodeIgniter? What makes you sacrifice the simplicity and performance of PHP? Chris, you and I are both working on
Rails. I'd be like, Oliver, why would you willfully ignore the simplicity and performance of Rails?
Ooh.
I mean, it's just so opinionated. It's like you can't end a sentence like that, you know? Like but I kind of get where he's coming from. In fact, I don't know. This is one of those things that, like, as a non-developer, really, like, I don't know where to draw this line, but I'm not like a hardcore back-end developer, as I'm sure everyone here is well aware. When I worked in PHP and the zillions of WordPress sites I've worked on and other PHP sites and stuff, it just seemed like they did just kind of work, right? You can write some PHP code and you can view that page on a server that supports PHP, and it runs the PHP and it does its thing. PHP can't really like fail. It can't like fall over. I don't have to go into the command line and be like, ugh, PHP died. I guess I got to restart it. But that seems to happen all the time in our Rails app. Not like on accident, but like, oh, we got to restart Rails because X reason or whatever, or I need to fire up the server that runs those things. It's like an active process on a server. I think PHP is an active process too, but I don't know why it like never dies. It seems weird to me that always like annoyed me with like, I don't feel like when I was just learning this stuff and years ago, I was like, why would I reach for Ruby? I just don't feel comfortable with that. Like which services need to be running. And sometimes I can write code or something can happen on my server that turns them off. And then my whole website is off. And I just don't understand that type of thing. Whereas PHP feels to me that it's just kind of always on.
Well, it kind of is. I mean, like MAMP is a great example. You turn on the PHP server, you know, like the Apache interface for your PHP. Anyway, why would you sacrifice the simplicity and performance of like, and let me make this better. Why would you move from like being a WordPress developer, very comfortable with PHP, to something like Rails? Why wouldn't you have requested, say, CodePen was built in CodeIgniter instead of Ruby on Rails?
We could have. I don't know. I think it was just you get a lot of cool, fun stuff for free in Rails, and it's just ends up being a nice language to write in and work with, and I kind of like it. I don't know that I'm qualified to kind of make these choices. I know the people that I worked with were very excited about making a Rails app because of that kind of thing. They came from a PHP land and couldn't wait to leave it behind. But to be fair, the PHP land that they came from was very manual. We wrote a lot of stuff from scratch. We used no framework at all. We just kind of hand wrote it. Like every database query was just raw SQL and that type of thing. And that world has changed a lot. So Oliver here is asking about CodeIgniter. I know from the people I follow and listen to and talk to around the world that Laravel is like incredibly popular and incredibly powerful and comes with just about the same type of tools and stuff that you'd expect with a Rails app. But I don't know that we need to like, you know, like get our swords out and draw a line in the sand that says, you know, PHP's over here and Rails is over here and these two frameworks are 1,000% different and require different amounts of thinking and stuff. They're the same, I guess I shouldn't draw the connection that they're exactly the same either. You know, I'm sure there's some considerations.
Say, you can get some tweets here.
That's fine, from my perspective, you get a lot of the same stuff. You get some type of like suggestions of how you should build and structure your app. You have some way to build. Me and Dave were just talking about routes earlier, and he's building an app that's up to 50 routes, and it's brand. You know, you're just starting to work on it. I was looking at our routes on CodePen. We have about 700 routes on there, but we manage that. Those are literally the URLs that are the kind of heart and soul of your app. What it's like. What URLs respond to what. You need some way to manage that. In PHP land, we didn't even there didn't always used to be a routing component. You used to just like put stuff in folders on your thing, and that was your routing. You know. Which is
that's the best old man quote. You just put stuff in folders.
Well, that's how you did routing in PHP.
No, that's true.
Yeah. Which is weird, but true, you know, and it's just not like that anymore. Routing is just as robust in these PHP apps as anywhere else, really.
I mean, so there's a few PHP benefits. Like you could switch to hip hop, which is what Facebook runs on, you know, like, you could end up there and get like some amazing performance things, you know, in with a tested environment. But for me, why I chose Rails, I've built things in CakePHP, which was a PHP Rails clone similar to CodeIgniter. And I've heard Laravel is really good. I think what I like about Rails, I was able to get like a little micro social network, godaytrip.com, get that up and running in like 3 months in my spare time. And I think that's kind of a testament to what Ruby on Rails is good at. It has so many conventions that you really just have to follow the convention tree. You're not like kind of inventing everything from scratch. And that's sort of how I felt with some other PHP frameworks in the past, was it was kind of like, yeah, you can like we have tasks to like, you know, you can script out a whole post model and you can script out a user model. But if you need authentication, like good luck, you'll have to figure that out. And I'm like, well, how does a user log in? I'm confused. This is hard. And Rails, it's like, what's the most popular or well used or well trotted authentication method? Well, that's the devised gem, so you have to install that and then learn how that works, but it's heavily documented. Well, okay, I'll do that, and like bingo bingo, I have like a user login model in like, I don't know, like an hour or something, you know, which is pretty incredible compared to the like go figure it out yourself bud sort of methodology. And so that's one reason, just one, I kind of went with Ruby and Rails, but you know, that decision may kick me in the butt. I mean, maybe Ruby and Rails isn't the as cool as it once was. So it's now falling out of favor with developers. And so now it's dead, you know, but for me and what I was setting out to do, this suited my needs. And Ruby's a pretty wonderful language to develop in. It reads like plain English to me, so that's nice.
So that seems fine, you know. That's good luck, Oliver. I mean, whatever. I'm sure that you'd be kind of happy in either, honestly. But your seems like your mind is already kind of attached to the PHP thing. Use Laravel. I'm sure you'll be fine. Or use.
I would like to hear from Oliver why he would choose a PHP. Why would you not want to learn anything different, or why do PHP only? Why is it the best? I would read that blog post. So, next question. Oh, or should we do a sponsor? Let's do our sponsor.
Yeah, why not? We only really have the one, and then we'll make up some stuff a little bit later. But this one is for CSS DevConf. So the URL to remember is cssdevconf.com. It'll redirect you to where you need to know. It is the this is its fourth one, and it's kind of known for being in really cool locations. This one's going to be really cool. It's aboard the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California, which I guess is kind of like the greater Los Angeles area, right? I haven't looked it on a map yet, but that's the impression that I'm under. But whatever, you just get on a plane and go there, because this is an Environments for Humans conference, but it's one of their in-person conferences. We're all going to go and hang out there. Me and Dave will be there. Val Head, Gina Bolton, Sarah Swaydan. People we've real recognized from the show. It should be pretty darn fun. It's October 26th, 27th, and 28th of this year. It tends to be in October. Should be pretty damn fantastic. The sessions are community picked and double blind, so it's kind of great. It's not a popularity contest. They're literally voted on without you seeing who had that talk. You know, you have to go through and vote based on the content of that talk that people write up. So I think that's pretty neat. So all of the sessions that you see are there through popularity of the idea only.
Queen Mary made its maiden voyage on May 27th, 1936.
It's nice. I'm working on designing some CodePen coasters for it, just kind of for fun. We did that 1 year, and like I decided to. We'll see if these pass muster. But there's these three giant smokestacks on top of it that look kind of iconic and awesome, and I'm gonna use those as the design element of it. I had to draw them in Illustrator. It was pretty rough, but I pulled it off.
It's good. I smell boat captain hats in our future. Oh. In the past, we've done coconut bras.
But yeah, I'm thinking like white and dark blue horizontal striped shirts.
Some good boat attire.
Yeah.
I already got the boat shoes. I'm already there.
Yeah, well, bring those. Don't forget those.
Okay.
Yeah, and it'll be fun. It's like literally a hotel on this, but it's not like we're going to go on the boat and, like, you know, they put us in the hull and we just talk. It's like a, you know, it's like a fancy hotel slash boat. Cool. Mm-hmm. So that'll be fun. CSSDevConf.com. We will see you there. Let's do another one by Annie B, who writes in, what do you think of jQuery's new CSS framework? I don't know. Have you seen this, Dave?
I have not seen it, but I'm curious.
Oh, really? It's been around for like a while. I don't know how super actively developed it's on right now. I mean, it's not years and years old, but I think it's like months and months old. The idea, let me read the, I'll just read aloud a little bit because it's kind of interesting. And it's interesting that's literally in the jQuery, organization on GitHub. Chassis is an attempt to create an open standards design for CSS libraries, JavaScript UI libraries, and web developers in general. This project will define standards for markup and class names for common widgets and patterns, as well as the implementation of those standards. Just like DOM libraries can build upon Sizzle, you know, the selector engine, we hope UI libraries will build upon this. So it's that same kind of like, if you want to build a UI library like Bootstrap or whatever, you could still start with this and then style it to be Bootstrap. That would be the idea, is that, like, can we have, like, Bootstrap's a good idea. Can we have lots of those, but base them all on the same set of HTML and class names? Would be the idea. Kind of interesting. The goals are, you know, broad device support, performance concerns, although I don't know how you maintain that if you let people add on whatever CSS they want to it. I'm not sure. And just kind of being web compliant and stuff like that. It's kind of interesting. I thought, you know, I was talked to early on about this, and like, it's a good idea, but it's just this. There's something about HTML and CSS that makes this like weirdly too hard. People are a little attached to how they want to do their HTML. That you can't just say, this is how you do HTML. Don't touch it. Style it how you want. It's just like, I don't know if it works. I don't know if it works. And I'm not saying that it doesn't work. I'm just saying that, like, I don't know. I had a little experience with another kind of related project that affect CSS, where it was kind of like, let's standardize, or not standardize, but make like a library of CSS effects, like, you know, the modal dialog box that swoops down from the top. Can we say that this is, if you want that effect in your app, we're going to make it really performant, we're going to make it really smooth and classy, and these are the classes that you need to do it. Well, it wasn't as simple as classes. It has to be HTML and classes. And then it turned out, well, to make kind of a compelling demo, we have to kind of use JavaScript as well, and JavaScript needs to be applying and removing those classes. And pretty soon it's like, there's too many dependencies to make it just kind of like, just grab this and use it. It just wasn't that simple. And it just ended up being like, I don't know that I would reach for this. It didn't feel right to me. So I kind of stepped away from that project. I feel like that this may kind of have this same thing involved. Like you have this vision in your mind that you just want, you know, like, why do we have to keep writing the drop-down menus over and over again? Can't one person write it and say, this is the best HTML and CSS possible to make this menu? Can I just use that as a component? It seems like a worthy goal, and then ends up just not being that easy.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I wonder if this thing, it seems like the spiritual successor to like jQuery UI or something. Like you're making a standard UI library, right? Like almost like Brad Frost Pattern Lab or something like that. But
does this make the like no? There's no JavaScript in this project whatsoever. Do they draw that line and say none?
Yeah, I think there is JavaScript, but it's interesting. Like, I'm trying to boot it up, but it like wants me to install CouchDB, and I'm not going to do that. So,
see, there's already dependencies, you know.
So yeah, it's pretty like for CSS. This is a lot of action. I can't even get it running, and I do web development for a living. So, not gonna comment too far. I think it's interesting. I don't know. I wonder where it could go. I do think I will say, I think everyone overthinks things all the time. Like, we all are like, oh, I'm going to write this from scratch. And it's like, don't. Like, just steal Bootstrap's version or something. Like, I don't know. Like, the media component where it's like an image with text out to the side. I mean, like, just copy Bootstrap or whatever.
I know. Like, it's so hard because the things aren't – and like, I was working on the CodePen redesign recently, and I want to use the priority plus navigation. You know, I'm talking about as a horizontal roll, and then things fall down in there. And I saw a really good demo. I saw found it on CodePen. I was like, this is nice. I like this. And I was like, I'm not going to overthink it this time. This is a component that is meant to be dropped in and used in the situation where you want priority plus nav. I'm going to use it. And then I just, it's not like I hate it, but it kind of took a good amount of work to get going. And then it, like, it does its thing with JavaScript, obviously, where it kind of measures some widths and decides what can fit and what can't and gets moved. So it really kind of, like, it makes the demo page runs no other JavaScript. So it's like really fast and you barely notice it. But in the world of CodePen, where we're kind of running a bit more JavaScript, I kind of have to make decisions about when I want it to execute and stuff. Cause if it's too slow, it looks a little janky. And then I was like, I wonder if I could fix some of that jank with some CSS stuff. Like, maybe I'll like wait to show the menu for a second before it's done its thing. And I'm like, oh, I can't have a menu that fades in. What is this? It's just a freaking row of links. It needs to just be there. And then now I'm trying to decide. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, I just wanted to use something that just works. And it's never that simple, you know?
Yeah. Now you're 100 lines of
code. Now I'm going to write my own, you know? It's like, yeah. Dang it.
No, I mean, yeah, I was doing a thing where I was like, you click a delete button and the little thing like slides off the page, you know, and it's like, I don't know if that component or animation or whatever exists. So I just wrote it myself rather than like look around for the perfect animation library to give me real physics on deleting and sliding a thing out. But, anyway, so I think it's cool. I don't know anything about CSS chassis, so I think it would be kind of wrong to talk about it specifically, but I will say I think it's cool that people are wanting to solve problems once, you know. I think about Polymer a lot. What if Polymer was just like a web SDK? You know, and this is everything you need to build a website. I have it. We give it to you every, you know, 6 weeks or something. We update it. That would be kind of cool. I mean, like, why wouldn't you use that? But then, like you're saying, Chris, there's probably this one circumstance that it doesn't work. So you have to roll your own. But maybe you only have to roll your own one component, not a whole roll your own everything. So maybe that solves a problem for you, or maybe it makes it way more complicated. I don't know.
There'll always be somebody that this highly appeals to, though, too, you know, that isn't so specific about how everything works. They're just like, oh, I mean, if I buy into this 100%, I can just kind of piece together a site and have it work great. You know, that's kind of the beauty of Bootstrap in a way. So, and if they could standardize Bootstraps, maybe there's some good to it. I'm not against the mission. I just think it's a tough one to, you need some serious buy-in here for this thing to work. All right. What do we got one here from Steve Kirkby here?
Steve Kirkby writes in, when I had apps in the App Store, it gave me a real boost if I got an email saying, keep up the great work or something familiar. Like, suddenly there's one person out there that thinks you've done a good job. It's easy to raise an issue on GitHub, but whoever just writes, great repo, you've made me look good.
And open an issue just to be like, you're great.
Yeah. So my question is, what software, app, repo, blog, website, or whatever could you use to thank developers, designers for, and why? Maybe your listeners can take 2 minutes to tweet, email some lone devs, designers who they think are doing good, and maybe a whole load of people can have a better day. Steve goes
pretty good
out to say, for me, it's Sublime Text, and the contributors of all the packages make it so damn useful. Aww.
No, it's pretty cool. You know, I like to do that. Like, if I have a good, because of course our tendency is to just ignore things when they're going well and lash out when things are going bad. I do it all the time, and I often regret it just seconds after doing it because it's just so friggin' tempting to open up a new tweet and be like, "Arr!" and lash out. I want people to know that I'm mad. God dang it. And it's so awful, and it's a bad tendency, and I try to fight it in myself all the time and often fail. But it's harder to reach out when you have a nice interaction. I think it's becoming a little bit more popular, though. I see, at least in the people I follow on Twitter, I see a good amount of high fives to people that feel a bit random. They just feel like, I just had a good experience. Check it out. And you're right, Steve. It does give those people a boost. Of course it does. It's, you know, this isn't this is very not related to tech in any way. Everybody and anything in the world enjoys a good compliment.
Yeah. I mean, the other day, I tweeted out, I've been thinking about this a little bit too. Like, it's so easy to be mean. And what if everyone like intentionally wrote one nice tweet a day? Like you consciously were like, I'm going to say something positive, like, today. Maybe it's a recommendation for software or a positive, you know, this software I like, or this repo I use, or this, you know, I don't know, person I am inspired by. What if we took like time once a day to kind of do that? But I recently tweeted about MindNode. It's like an app for Mac. It has what does it have? It has, it's like a mind mapping software. So it's basically you create a node and then you can like add nodes to that node. And it just creates a little flow charty kind of thing. And I tweeted, I really like it. And people are like, oh, this looks great. I could use this. And then like the developers are favoriting my tweet. And it's just kind of like, it's cool that you can like, I feel like Twitter is probably the good medium versus to congratulate people. It's maybe a little more public. They get a little more reward out of like a hidden issue where they're like automatically defensive to like, oh, what the hell is this? You know? So I think, yeah, I think, you know, opening, you know, and if you do file an issue on GitHub, it's totally fine to open up your issue filing. Like, hey, love the project. I hit this issue today. You can also do that. So that's what I would say, huh?
Yeah, you know, if setting a goal to do it once a day or for a week or something works for you, that's cool. Sometimes I feel like having the pressure to do that is a little much, so I prefer to kind of think of it as a kind of a, yeah, I like that thing, so I'm gonna thank them. You know, it's one that comes to mind a little bit, and perhaps it's cliche or whatever, but is Slack. Slack is amazing. Slack, it works really well. It's amazing the success that they've had. I really like that their business plan of where they draw the line for what you pay for and what you don't. It feels very fair. It never goes down magically, even though it's a connected service. Like, I've never seen a moment of Slack downtime, which maybe they have had some, but I've never seen it, which is amazing considering the amount of traffic and stuff that must go in there. People are slinging files around, uploading stuff, sharing stuff with teams. Jeez, it's such like big, complicated software. They have apps for all these platforms. It just feels like it came out of nowhere and they're just killing it. And congratulations to all the people involved at Slack, because you're doing a good job.
Yep. Good piece of software there. All right. Well, hopefully that helps. I think if you want to follow Steve's encouragement, say something nice.
Thanks something, and yeah, feel free to, I mean, you don't have to, it's tempting to like invent a hashtag or let us know that you did it or whatever, but we don't have to make this about Shop Talk Show. You should just do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep, that's a nice thing. And speaking of people that and things that we like, Syndicate Ads is interesting. So I thought we'd mention that just because we don't have a second ad here, and it's probably because we're kind of moving over to having them help us book ads through that, which I think is kind of fantastic because it's a bunch of work. This is us kind of outsourcing something to make it easier on us and reach potentially more advertisers that they know about that we don't. And I don't know, it's mostly just to free up some of our time because, you know, Shop Talk Show is great. We want to keep doing it forever, and in order to do that, we tend to need to kind of outsource some of the work that's involved. So they're doing our advertising now, and thank you so much to Celeste and Matthew and Todd and all the people involved over there at Syndicate Ads, they're kind of connected to buy sell ads, but the deal with Syndicate is that they sell like sponsored posts on blog posts and more like kind of more unusual places to publish do advertising. So I'm not sure if they do a ton of podcast stuff or not, but we reached out to them to help us with Shop Talk advertising and they're doing it. So thanks. Shout out to them. I think they do a great job.
Yep. No, that's good. All right. Well, Alessandro Moraro writes in, I know lots have been done to get image source specs, and I appreciate it. However, I'm a bit worried that it might have been wasted time. How can I decide what image size to serve when I have no clue about my user's internet speed or data plan? Perhaps the best option is to serve the best compromise and give users the option to willingly access a bigger image. I think the good old... I think the good old CSS background image and media queries are enough.
So all of a sudden, when he says image source specs, I think he's talking about the source set attribute possibly on images or the picture element. He's talking about the new school ways to deal with responsive images. And he's thinking maybe all that was a big waste of time. I'm sure there's some people that would agree with you and people that would disagree with you. It's a little, you know, however you feel about it, too late. It's being implemented in browsers as we speak. And the idea, when you say, how can I decide what image to serve when I have no clue about my internet's speed or data plan, I think that was considered. That was thought about a bit. And it's not you making that choice as an author. It's not you saying... serve this image when they're on, you know, on Edge, and serve this image when they're on LTE or whatever the distinguishing factors are. As you listen to this show, it's you saying, "I'm going to give the I have these with the source set attribute anyway. I have these different versions of this image, and I might even tell you how big I'm going to be displaying that image on the page, and then you kind of leave it up to the browser to make choices about when it's going to use those. Source set is a little bit more hands off. It's a little bit like, these are the images I have available, and here's what I know about them as they're going to display on the page, and I want the browser to decide what it's best for." So a lot of times it makes that choice based on like the pixel density of that and what image is going to be the best pixel density. And I'm not sure if any browsers are doing this yet, but the spec is intentionally left to say, but it's kind of up to the browser. If the browser has, for example, wants to factor in internet speed or data plan or things like that, it can if it wants to. And so that's kind of great, you know. I don't know, like, if it's probably best to leave that to browsers, let alone let having it be an author choice seems like a little dangerous to me. So I wouldn't say that has been forgotten. In fact, I think that Alessandro, that has been considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the whole idea is that the browser could set it. Like, if you're on a proxy browser, like Opera Mini, it's only going to ever go for the smallest image. And that's kind of where the power of the 1x, 2x kind of stuff comes in. Because if if the browser detects, like, hey, this guy's or girl's Wi-Fi is very, very shoddy, very bad connection, it's like negative edge network, then we're just gonna only do the 1x source and we'll never do a 2x source because this is really bad. Or, you know, it opens up the browser setting, you know, different browser settings. Maybe you're like, you know, I am going on an international vacation, I'm gonna set all my phone to low bandwidth mode, and then that's gonna only send me 1x images. So that's an option too. I think like if it kind of, I think like we should have control as developers, like a bandwidth thing. Like, I should be able to negotiate that. But I also think like the browser can make very smart choices here personally.
And he says, I think CSS background image and media queries are good enough. That, of course, factors into this conversation. It always does. I feel like that should be pointed out, that responsive images are content images. They're images that are in the content of, they're in HTML on purpose because that's where they belong, because there's something like an image of a maple leaf in an article about maple leaves, and that's where that image belongs. It's a part of the content of that article. It should go, it could go to the website, it could go to the mobile app, it could go to an RSS feed, it could go out to a newsletter that gets generated from that content. That's where that image of that maple leaf belongs. That's different from CSS. CSS is the design of the site. That's like, it's a site about leaves and there's a leaf pattern in the background. It's not really part of the content of the site. It's just decorative stuff back there. Responsive images are largely solved in CSS in that through media queries. You can change which background image you display based on media queries and it will display different ones. It's not the conversation around responsive images. Like, that already works. Browsers are generally smart enough to only download the one that they need. Now, it should be said that maybe it's not entirely solved and that SourceSet might even be doing a better job because it leaves that idea. Like, when you say, browser, at this media query, download this background image, it has no choice. It has to follow your instructions. And that's how the picture element works as well. You're giving it specific, for the most part, at least part of it, is you giving it specific instructions about which media query matches, and then if that matches, down you are instructed to download this image. That's what's happening in CSS well, and it doesn't leave any interpretation for the browser to decide things like what's the internet speed, what's the data plan on this particular phone kind of situation. CSS doesn't have any way to offer that really at the moment. It does have image set. I wonder if there's a way forward for that, but
I think that's sort of stalled out at this point. Yeah. But I think it's coming, but it's kind of stalled out.
So, you know, like it's solved in CSS, but maybe we could do better. Anyway, do you want to move on or you have?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the CSS solves decoration images, not content images. Right. So, like, your CSS means nothing if your article is going over the wire to a RSS reader, you know, like. The RSS reader is going to be like, yeah, no images. I get it. You know, so
this has to be a declarative HTML thing. You can't just be like, well, okay, well, have you guys thought about JavaScript? Maybe we could, you know, test how fast this file comes down and comes back, and then we'll change the source on the image when we have learned that information. Like, these conversations are not to be ignored, but have been had. And then,
so I it's a dream to know the user speed, but it's way off, and you know, I don't know. We'll get there eventually, but all right. Boo! Next question. Mitch Jackson writes in, what's the best way to deal with SVG icons? Is it best to put them in line or add them within the CSS as background image URL? And how's the best way to deal with different changes on hover, such as color changes? Mm. So two questions, inline or like background image SVG icons, and then how do you change the color of things?
Well, they don't necessarily need to be mutually exclusive. In fact, this is probably a good time to just talk about how Grunticon works, and that the latest version of Grunticon, the way it has always worked is you take this folder full of SVG icons, Mitch, I'm sure you have one of these, and process it through Grunticon. And what it gives you is a bunch of different .css files, ultimately. One of them, the success scenario largely is that it's data URIs of each of those SVG icons right in the CSS file. So it has successfully squished all those SVG files into one resource, which is what you want when you're dealing with icons, to reduce the number of requests for efficiency. And then each one of them icons has its own class name. It'll have like .icon/house or whatever, and you'll go to a span element or something and put class equals icon.house on there, and it will apply that background image to that span, and you're kind of off to the races there. You have a little element on your page that has the correct icon involved. And it's kind of on you to set the background sizing and size that span just how you want it and stuff. And Grunticon gives you some fallbacks as well. So it asks you to run a little JavaScript at the top of the page, which tests the scenario. And then if it fails, it won't load that success scenario CSS file. It will load one with data URIs of PNGs instead. And apparently there's a way that it can fail so badly that it needs to load a third different CSS file that just links out to PNG files. I'm not sure what browser that is, but it's something. And Grunticon deals with that. Now, in the latest version of Grunticon, it will also say that if there's a particular attribute present on that span, it will progressively enhance up to inline SVG. So instead of it being a CSS background image, it will literally put the inline SVG element in there. And the advantage to that is that, like you said, you want to do a color change on hover. Well, you can do that now because you can change the fill color of the SVG in your CSS. So that's what it enables, which is kind of great. And the fallback still works. So Grunticon is pretty cool that way. I have a post about approaching it in a slightly different way where you start with inline SVG. And the use element, I think that's kind of a nice way to go. And then you fall back to using Grunticon. So it's just a slightly different approach. The idea being that in the future, if you kind of feel like not caring about fallbacks anymore and your build process is getting more complicated than you like, you can pull out Grunticon and it will still work fine. So it kind of assumes a success scenario and you deal with the fallback. Just a different way to approach it. I don't really care which way you go. I just happen to like, you know, they both have their merits. Cool. So yeah, but let's say you want to change the color and you're not progressing enhancing to inline SVG. You just want to change the color and you're just using CSS background images. You can't really. There's no way to change that on the fly. I've seen some kind of hack ways to do it. One of which is to just change out the background image with a different inline SVG, or, you know, with different data URI SVG that is a different color. And the kind of like cool, tricky part about that is like, oh my gosh, you have to repeat two different data URIs in a row in the CSS file. Isn't that hugely bloaty? And it's not really, because it's this long string of characters that, you know, that is the instructions on how that SVG is drawn. But the only difference is one little fill attribute. So as we have talked about gzip in the past, that will gzip to nothing. You know, you could have the same, you know, 1,000 character string in a CSS file. And if it's the same and it's in there 1,000 times, it will gzip to nothing, because gzip is really good at smashing repetitive content. So I know that was long-winded, Mitch, but I would probably check out Grunticon for the type of things that you mentioned.
Yep. Yeah. I like the inline SVG thing. That's kind of my preferred just SVG use.
Drop some U's right up in the document. Yeah, that's kind of how I roll
and
as well.
SVG for everybody to kind of fix that. But I don't worry about it in IE8. I need to write a post. I kind of started one and then I never finished it, but my feelings is a lot of the time SVG icons are used for decoration, not content. And in theory, if an icon doesn't need a fallback, don't worry about it.
That's a very good point. That's when you're thinking about fallbacks in general, That's definitely the case. So if it was a button that said home and it had a little house icon next to it, if the house icon isn't there, who cares? So yeah, I remember when you were working on this, that was not the case generally. You're thinking of situations in which the icon is the thing.
Yeah, and when the icon is the thing, like you didn't have the hamburger icon is a perfect you know, example. Like, what are you gonna fall back to? Probably the word menu. Right. So like, you know, maybe there's some JavaScript and this is graceful degradation, not progressive enhancement. See our last episode. In graceful degradation, you're just saying data like fallback equals menu or some text or some Unicode. And that won't always work within your layout, or it might totally break your whole layout. But I like to think of things in that way, like, could this just fall back to text? Or, you know, you could also go the other route where you progressively enhance, like you convert it to an SVG. But that's actually, that's like 10 times as much JavaScript. Or you could have two elements and then show one or show the other one based on whether or not it has SVG support. So those would be my kind of That's my new way of thinking. I try to think of it in terms of like, is this thing necessary? Could I do something different? But yeah, that's where I'm at. It doesn't really work for big images, but with like big SVGs, like let's say you have that tiger SVG and the hero of your website, you know, you can use Picture Element now to fall back. Like your PNG is the normal source, and then you have the image of part of the picture, and then you use picture source equals my thing SVG and load in like an SVG, enhance the SVG. And if the browser supports picture, not all of them do, but one day they will. So that's how I like to approach it.
Fantastic. Let's see. We have time for a couple, maybe one or two more here. We'll see how it goes. Mitch Jackson. Oh no, we just did Mitch's. Good luck, Mitch, with your SVG. Noel Pena writes in, I'm working on a redesign for an old website. Should I begin by creating the style guide and then using it as a reference for myself when I'm building out the design? Or should the style guide be born out of my redesign?
The pattern lab before the horse, I believe.
I wonder what Brad would, I actually don't know what, not that, you know, like I just think of Brad because I kind of think of, well, he's got this thing, he works on with some other people too, of course, but he's kind of known for it. The idea of atomic design and it's great. I mean, it's easy to explain, right? You can think of, atoms as being something like a button, and then you think of a molecule as being like a little form that has that button in it. And then you think of, I don't know, how does it go up from a molecule? Like a organism. Yeah. And then, becomes maybe like a larger form or a multiple, you know, it's just something bigger, and then pages or whatever at the top, even though I don't think they say pages, right? Because pages is a bad word, apparently.
Templates than pages. So you have a page has like actual real data stuffed into it.
Yeah. What would you say if Brad were here? Would he say, like, when I'm designing a brand new site and it's, let's say I'm going to build the homepage for Slack or whatever, because we just talked about that. Like, would I design the button first, or would I
let me channel Brad Frost.
Okay.
Hey, Chris, Dave, you guys are really cool. I'm Brad Frost. I've
flopped Surf's hair. Up.
Surf's up, bro.
Brad.
The answer to your pattern lab question is whatever. I think that's what Brad would say. Love you, Brad. It's tough. I like, in practice, it would be cool to kind of decide all the little buttons and then like build up. But I think like in reality, how it kind of works is you kind of just kind of draw pages. And then you just break those up, and then you like, and then you start, like, we usually will like kind of Photoshop out like three-ish pages, you know, and then from there you kind of see the like tie-ins. Oh, that's the same thing as that. That's the same thing as that. That's the same thing as that. Perfect. Let's start. Let's break these up into molecules, and then we have these in our cache of tools to build more pages. So we kind of like have a kind of consistent theme built across a few templates. But then like you build it out to have that consistency. And then it's a matter of like injecting new ones when you need one. I think that's the best way to kind of build that out. So, but then there are things in your style guide that should inform the rest of your design, like colors, type, you know, you can kind of set heading sizes. That'll actually make your design process in Photoshop even faster. So colors, type, grid, you know, the atoms level stuff, you know, that should help pretty quite a bit.
I hope so. Yeah. I kind of like the design some stuff first and then build the style guide out of that. And then let the style guide future pages, kind of like that's more of a, I don't know. I think I called it the hippie colony version of the style guide. I have this post where the style guide fits into the process, which is largely typed from some Brad Frost stuff anyway, but it's kind of like you can do this one where you start with the style guide and then move forward. You can do one where the style guide is this like exhaust process that happens elsewhere. You can have it kind of be part of the thing where if I'm building a new page, I can reach for elements from the style guide, and the pages that I design can influence the style guide as well, and just kind of used for kind of checks and balances with the design. I kind of prefer that back and forthy kind of thing. That it would feel weird to me to start with start from absolute scratch with the style guide.
Yeah, I like what you're doing with CodePen. You kind of like built a site out. Boom, we have a website, and now you built out your little style guide page based on what you had. So you're kind of taking an inventory, and then now you may like once you take an inventory, you're like, why are component one and component two so different? Could those be one component? And you can make that decision. That's what we're doing with Daytrip. Like we kind of built out a site because we didn't want to be limited by this, kind of false limitation. But so we kind of like organically just grew out a few templates and pages. But now we're at the point where it's like, oh, that's the same thing as that, but it has a button. So like, let's code those the same way. So it's kind of cool to see it working out. And so what I'm going to do is, like you did, I'm going to build a style guide after the fact to kind of add more consistency to the project as going forward. So
yeah, it gives you a chance to do an inventory and
yeah, like, and I, yeah, it's pretty cool. So yeah. Well, I think that's all the time we have, Chris. Womp, womp, wow. This has been another beautiful rapid fire episode.
Maybe one time we'll try the thing again where we do the songs in 2 minutes. We used to do that thing once in a while where we'd try to do extra many by limiting our time. Maybe we'll do that again. Let us know if you'd really like to see that again or not. I don't really care. It's just kind of a fun one. Like, we do have kind of a backlog of questions. So
it's like a challenge. It's like a physical challenge. And we hear more voices. And you can always ask a question again. But this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for listening, everybody. Be sure to rate this 5 in your podcatcher of choice, star hearted. That's how people find out about the show. Then follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And if you hate your job, get a new one over at shoptalkshow.com/jobs, powered by the CodePen job board. And I'm trying to think, we're going to have a couple rapid fires, a couple guests, kind of working our way to another incarnation of the Shop Talk Show. But it's summertime.
We have some ideas for, in the summer, we're just going to blast through here. We're not going to skip any weeks probably, but there'll be rapid fires. There'll be a guest here and there, that kind of thing. And then
I'm getting sunburned on a beach right now as you're listening to this.
So good.
Yeah. So we'll have to kind of, we'll be in and out, but just want to catch you up on our plans for the summer, but yeah, we're going
to
be back.
You're going to San Diego, right?
San Diego.
Oh man, I had a taco there last time I was there that had like cheese that was like crisped up, and the toppings were, it was like a puddle of cheese on a hot flat top, and they put the toppings in the puddle of melted cheese until the bottom of the cheese kind of started to crisp up, and then rolled that and put that in the tortilla.
So it's like a gratin.
It's like inside.
Oh, a gratin.
Yeah. It's right there, San Diego. Anyway, have fun, Dave.
Yeah.
And
Surf's up, bro. Thanks, Brad. Thanks.
We'll see you all later. ShopTalkShow.com.